In a logo, stars twinkle in the sky. Our view drifts down through clouds to a river that winds past hillsides. A train crosses a bridge. As a flag waves on top of a castle's tallest spire, a bright display of fireworks explodes in the sky. A glowing pinpoint of light arcs over the castle, leaving a trail of sparkling dust. Words appear. Walt Disney Pictures. In a small room, black and white photos cover the walls along with some framed posters. An older, dark-haired man enters. He sits at a small piano by the door. Near a window, a gray-haired man wears a focused expression as he works. The dark-haired man plays the piano. The gray-haired man uses a wedge-shaped tool on a canvas. Working on his painting, he looks to the side. Two Academy Award statuettes sit nearby. Archival footage shows the 37th Annual Academy Awards. Words appear. Fred Astaire, April 5th, 1965.
For the best song, the winner is...
Fred stands at a podium.
The winners are Richard M. Sherman and Robert G. Sherman. Chim Chim Saree.
Wearing black tuxedos, two dark-haired young men walk to the stage. One brother uses a cane. At the podium, they accept the golden statuettes from Fred. Richard and Robert's names appear as they face the crowd.
Say, all you can say is supercalifragilistic.
Expialidocious.
Mary Poppins.
So many people know their songs, but not many people really know the words.
Chim chiminy, chim chiminy, chim chim chiree. When you're with a sweep, you're in glad company.
Mary Poppins has to be one of the most beloved movies ever made. And it would not have been half the picture it is without the music it has.
Let's get together, yeah, yeah, yeah. Why don't you and I combine? Let's get together, what do you say? We could have a swinging time.
You cannot forget a Sherman Brothers song for your entire life.
Ooby-doo, ooby-doo. I want to be like you.
Hop-dee-hooby-doo-ba.
I want to walk like you. Talk like you.
Choo-choo.
I remember the songs more than I remember the movie itself.
The wonderful thing about tickers is tickers are wonderful things. The tops are made of the rubber, the bottoms are made of the strings. The bouncy, flouncy, flouncy, pouncy, fun, 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 fun. But the most wonderful thing about tickers is I'm the only one.
So many memorable tunes and songs and moments that touch your heart.
I'm just a little black rain cloud hovering under the honey tree.
These are the people who wrote every song that every child has grown up with.
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing the word
and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
With modern media, television, movies, and Disneyland, they just were in this extraordinary position to have a gigantic impact.
Ringo Starr sings a Sherman Brothers song. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Can you believe the output of those two gentlemen? All these great, great songs.
Bang, bang, chitty, chitty, bang, bang. Our fine four-finger. Chitty, chitty, bang, bang. Chitty, chitty, bang, bang. Fine four-finger. Chitty, chitty, bang.
I'd never be the success that I am if he wasn't the success that he is, because we did it together.
We had no sibling rivalry when it came to writing.
I didn't pull away from him. He pulled away from me.
The hardest part was...
Robert Sherman shakes his head.
I don't know.
We've perpetrated a facade for 50 years.
An image of Richard Sherman fades to black. A title appears, The Boys, The Sherman Brothers Story.
I'm Greg Sherman. I'm Dick's son.
I'm Bob Sherman's son, Jeff. I met my cousin Greg 4 years ago at a Sherman Brothers event.
It was the opening of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang in 2002.
His family was sitting all the way to one side of the theater, and my family was sitting all the way to the other side of the theater.
After the performance, Jeff and I spoke all night. It was the first time we'd talked in almost 40 years.
I never saw him, I never talked to him, and we lived 7 blocks apart.
Here were two men that devoted their careers to writing family entertainment music, and yet neither one of them could get their families together.
A photo shows the brothers.
My father and his brother Dick worked closely together for over 50 years, yet there was a lot of animosity between the two brothers.
And I was told, when you're older, you'll understand. It's better this way. And I got older, and I still had no idea why.
So we tried to figure it out.
Glimpses show double-decker buses on the busy streets of London. In the back of a car, Bob Sherman stares out the window as he rides down a street. Dick Sherman drives down a road in Beverly Hills.
Bob and I are 2.5 years and about 5 eons apart. We are different people.
Dad, since you moved to London, do you miss Los Angeles?
I don't miss it at all. I really don't.
A photo shows the brothers as kids.
Funny thing about brothers, you don't forget that relationship no matter how old you get. I'm still the kid brother.
Wearing sunglasses, Dick stares ahead. Signs in a building read, Mary Poppins. Bob sits inside a theater.
I'm going to ask basic questions to start, okay? How's the sound? Can you hear him? Okay, good. Hi, Dad.
Howdy.
In Los Angeles, Dick steps out of his car. He meets Greg and Jeff outside a house.
Good to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You ready to take a journey backwards?
This is going to be wonderful.
Bob and Dick's childhood home.
I've never set foot inside the house since 1940. We had a company called the Alley Productions. That was when we were little boys. We got bawled out by the folks because we had taken this newly painted garage.
We had a pot full of blue paint and we wrote Alley Productions and it dripped. We had 2 sawhorses and planks. And we used to put a place.
Bob was the director, producer, writer, and I was the performer. I would be the star.
One thing I wrote was Avalon. He was a strange guy from outer space.
I am Avalon, the soul searcher, looking for an honest soul. Bob did not approve. I did my own variations.
He did whatever he wanted to do.
The kids would just sit on the ground here?
No. We had stools for them. No. This was a high-class operation.
Was there any business aspect to the Alley Playhouse?
We had to charge 1 or 2 cents. Dick used to let all his friends in. If they didn't have pennies, he'd let them in anyway.
Bob didn't like that. He said, no, they got to pay to see the show. And Mom and Dad would always stand in the back like he's watching us. And they never made us unpaint the door. We were a very close-knit family. We used to have a slogan, always together, always one.
They loved me. They loved him. I was Bobby Boy. He was Dickie Boy.
Voice of Bob Sherman.
Dad was a tremendous kite maker. And he used to take us out on weekends and buy string and buy paper and mucilage. And he'd make these marvelous kites that would fly forever. Kids would gather around and he'd give them kites.
Let's go fly a kite, Mary Poppins.
He landed it. It's wonderful. However, did you manage it?
With tuppence for paper and strings, you can have your own set of wings. With your feet on the ground, you're a bird in flight. With your fist holding tight to the string of your kite. Oh, let's go fly a kite.
On Sundays, Grandpa Al would come to the house and he'd give me a piano lesson. When the wind would start blowing, he'd just sort of point to the door
And I and my whole family would run across the street to this little round park, and we'd make and fly kites. And I remember in the early days, Greg's family and my family would do this all together. And those are great times.
Glimpses show black and white photos.
My father was born in a little town outside of Kiev. And in the year 1909, the Sherman family immigrated from the old country to America.
As a young man, Grandpa Al got a job as a mood music pianist for silent motion pictures at Biograph Studios in the Bronx. That's where he met Rose Dances. It's hard
to see a needle. Photos show Alan Rose.
My mother, she's an actress. She's in silent films. She's a lovely lady.
Robert B. Sherman, born December 19, 1925. Richard M. Sherman, born June 12, 1928.
Music and the entire show business was really centered in New York City. The Brill Building at Tin Pan Alley. That's where all the songwriters gathered and plugged their records and got record deals.
Al Sherman was a Tin Pan Alley songwriter.
Robert Osborne, film historian.
You had to be at the top of your game, because if you didn't get the job, somebody else would win it.
Well, sorry, I've got to have something with snap. Potatoes
are cheaper. Al had his first big hits composing bright, optimistic songs during the Great Depression. Many were recorded by vaudeville stars who were moving into the talkies. Al Jolson, Helen Kane, Rudy Valley, and Eddie Cantor.
And my dad, Jerry Stiller, would go around doing potatoes are cheaper, tomatoes are cheaper. I don't even know what this means, but apparently Eddie Cantor did this.
Ben Stiller mimics Eddie's clapping.
Now's the time to fall in love. Now's the time to fall in
love. What we recognize as the American sound, so much of it came from people like Aaron Copland or George Gershwin. Similarly, Al Sherman. Interestingly enough, all three of them were first-generation children of immigrant Russian Jews.
In 1931, Al Sherman plays a piano.
Probably the least likely people you could imagine that were able to manufacture what we all recognize as being quintessentially American. It's kind of in the history of music, it's a miracle.
During the 30s, there was a tremendous migration of pop songwriters that were coming out to Hollywood. And Dad was hired. Somebody wanted him.
We drove to California in an old Chevy.
It was a long, tedious trip out to California. I remember that we had no air conditioning at the time, so it was blistering hot. This is about the day he arrived in California. The executive that had hired him died. So here he was with his children and his wife and no job. But even though we were going through tough times, Dad always wrote optimistic songs.
I'm so happy, happy-go-lucky me. I just go my way, living every day.
The fortunes of songwriting are such that we had to move up and I had to change friends, go to different schools. Terrible thing.
There's no paycheck at the end of the week. It was just, maybe you'll have some song that makes some money or not.
Sam Goldwyn, Jr., producer.
I met Bobby at El Rodeo School. He was extremely observant. It's an impression of shy, kind of very interesting eyes that always were very alert, watching.
Sammy, he used to come to my house. We spent a lot of time together. He's my best friend.
I remember my father once saying to me, friends, friends, you're very lucky if you got one friend. And you happen to be very fortunate with that German boy. I remember Bob was very proud of his father. And the first thing he did was to explain, well, he wrote a song. I said, what was the song? And he said, you gotta be a football hero.
To get along with the beautiful girl, you gotta be a football hero.
Now, you and Dick, as kids, were you close?
Not really. We were never close as kids. Didn't know him that well.
We adored each other. I mean, I looked up to Bob. He was my hero.
When I grew up, I wanted to be a writer. Novels and plays. I used to write poetry.
About everything. Mother's Day, Father's Day, birthdays.
weekdays, Bob could recite a poem and everybody said, oh, isn't Bobby wonderful? He's wonderful. And Dickie was sitting there being a dweeb. This was a very large cedar closet that was Bob's dark room. And the heads would roll if you went in there when he was working because it destroyed his...
Did he go in here with Sam Goldman?
Yeah, they Bob and Sammy used to work in there all the time. And
could this have been this?
Well, let me see.
A doorknob falls off. Dick picks it up.
I'm up to my old tricks. You see that roof?
Yeah.
There was like an open area here. I would jump off the roof just to create the illusion that I could fly. I certainly did weird things like that. I used to jump out of trees a lot.
You got your accolades through your achievements. How did he get attention?
He had asthma.
Bob smiles.
He ended up in military school. How did that come about?
Well, there's various versions. I think he tried to burn the school down.
I didn't burn down the school.
Dick wears a frustrated look.
I was playing with matches. I mean, that's not the same thing.
Did it change him?
He had a nice uniform.
A photo shows Bob looking at Dick in his uniform.
There's a job to do, there's a fight to win. Follow me, boys, follow me.
We were in the war, and I wanted to go and kill the Germans. I prevailed upon my parents. They finally signed my permission. So at 17, I enlisted in the Army.
So you went overseas. Where did you go?
Oh, from France to Belgium, to Holland, to Luxembourg, finally to Germany. Well, we were taken to a little town called Breidenbeck. The captain says, fix bayonets and we'll charge.
Soldiers fight in the snow.
And we're shooting. And as I was crossing a field, I got hung up on some barbed wire. And by the time I untangled myself, a machine bullet hit me in the knee. And that's the last I remember for a while.
Bob fidgets with his hands.
He was really in bad shape when I saw him after the war. Really, it was very upsetting. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe the shape he was in. And I was worried he wasn't going to live very long. The pain was just killing him. And look what a survivor he is.
A photo shows the brothers as young men.
I had just graduated from high school, and Bob had gotten out of the Army.
And I wrote some short stories, typed them up, sent them out to about 12 different magazines. One day, on the hospital ward, they said, there's a telephone call for you. This is Grace Fischler from Coronet Magazine. She said, well, we're going to publish your stories one every month. She said, henceforth, anything else you write, I'd like to see first. I said, I never met a person who used the word henceforth.
We were both going to go to Bard College, New York State, and I had to declare a major for myself. Bob wanted to go into literature. He knew that. I was all of 17 in a terrible, terrible depression, and I decided to take a walk. And as I walked, I was hearing music, and I was wondering, where is this music coming from?
A black and white photo shows young Dick.
And I realized it was coming from my own head, so I darted back to the apartment where we had a little piano and started picking it out on the piano, this feeling I had. I'd never done that before, never. And my father said, what are you doing here? What is this? I said, well, this is something I felt. I had to say it. This is what I feel. He says, you're going to be a music major. That's when it happened.
Dick plays a piano. Rain Street by Dick Sherman, 1946. An old photo shows younger Dick writing on sheet music. In the present, he smiles softly as he finishes playing. A black and white photo shows Bard College in New York.
Because of the war, Bob and I both entered Bard College at the same time. He was a war veteran, you know, and I was just a wet behind the ears kid. And the 2.5 years that we were separated by years became 10 years because he had lived so much more than I had.
I looked at things a lot differently. So he went with his friends. I went with mine. We didn't speak much to each other. That's the way it went.
Would you go home for, like, a Christmas break or anything?
I stayed at school, and it was boring because nobody was there. Dick had a girlfriend, and he went to their home.
It was kind of a childhood romance, you know, that type of thing. We sort of got married. That's one of those things that we did. It was a mistake, but a beautiful thing happened. We had a little girl named Linda, whom we both adored. After school, reality hit us. We came back to California, and all of a sudden, I had to make a living.
My grandfather had a very well-established dry cleaning business, and he wanted Dad to go into the business because he knew it could support his wife and child.
It was kind of terrifying because I wanted to be a songwriter more than anything in the world. I'd rather do that than breathe. It would be a very unhappy marriage to keep going like this. And it had to end. And I had my clothing and a few articles that I owned at the little apartment that I shared with my first wife. I needed help to get the stuff out of there. And I said, Bob, you got to help me. I just can't do this by myself.
You remember having to go to his then-wife's place and getting his stuff and helping him move out?
Don't remember.
And it was a very embarrassing thing for him to go through this, but he said, okay, I'll do it. You know, I'll do it for you. He said, you owe me, kid. I said, I know, Bob, I owe you. And he collected one day on that one.
Just when you're sure of a dream that you planned, that's when the scenery changes. It changes.
Disney Forum, 1982.
We both really didn't necessarily want to be songwriters. What I wanted to be was a great symphonic composer, and Bob...
I wanted to write the great American novel.
He was determined.
Or at least the California novel.
And after graduation from college, we both set about to do that. I was writing my great symphonic sketches, and Bob was writing chapter after chapter of the most boring dribble you've ever read in your life. And I would say that about the music I was writing, too, because I don't want to just, you know, single you out for achievement sort of in that department. But one day, our dad...
It was good punctuation.
Dick smiles.
It's something I've never really completely understood. You guys were very different, lived different lives, had different friends, but you still chose to live together. Why was that?
It was economically good because our folks were giving us the money.
Bob and I took a little apartment over a cleaning store.
Dick always had his papers and everything all set up on the ironing board. I don't think they could afford a desk at that point. So.
And the lady next door, who was upstairs, was deaf. So I could play the piano all I wanted, and Bob could pound on his typewriter as much as he wanted. One day, our dad came up to our little apartment. He said, I'll bet you two guys couldn't pool your talents and come up with a song that some kid would give up his lunch money to buy. Bob and I both kind of looked at each other and said, we could, you know, do something.
So we tried it, and it wasn't easy. It was very difficult.
Dad used to say, the three S's, keep it singable, simple, and sincere, and original.
He was the greatest teacher. Finally, after about 3 or 4 months, he said, you got a hook here in this one idea.
And it was called, Gold Can Buy, anything but Love.
He pointed us in the direction of Hollywood and Vine, and he said, there are a lot of publishers out there. Now you go play them for them.
Finally, one publisher said, you know, I think it's a pretty good song. We were overjoyed because Gene Autry had recorded it, and he was the number one country western singer of the day.
And now, here's our newest Columbia recording that we think is going to be a big hit.
Love, love, love.
Well, people on Vine Street were congratulating us. They heard it on the radio. Said, how does it feel having a hit for your first time out? And we said, we don't know, you know, we don't know yet.
One day we heard an announcer on the station saying, and now we're going to hear Gene Autry's smashing hit is breaking all records. And we were ready to congratulate ourselves.
We started spending the money mentally. President Truman had recalled General MacArthur and had asked him to resign.
And MacArthur made a speech, and he concluded his speech when he said, I remember the old barracks room ballad.
That old soldier
never die. They just fade away.
And Mr. Autry decided to record it that the same day. Our song was called off the presses. It never saw the light of day again. And that was the end of our career as songwriters, we felt. By some amazing miracle, our father seemed to know we were going to be charging into Hollywood to speak to our publisher. And he cut us off at the pass. He says, I know what you're thinking, but if you can't learn to take a curve in this business, get out of the business.
One, press it up, two, three, four, by the right for single file, over every jungle mile.
I was going to be drafted, and I joined the Army Reserve.
He never saw any kind of action.
Never killed anybody. He started conducting the band.
I never fired a shot in anger. I shut my mouth off a lot.
Wipe off that silly grin, soldier. This is the Army.
I met the Sherman Brothers kind of collectively back in the very early 50s. All of our friends were struggling artists, if you will. We had practically every week our pals over, and we'd run pictures. Bob was there, and Joyce was there, but they didn't come together. They just met there.
She was an airline stewardess. I was struck with her. She was gorgeous. Slim, suntanned. I called her and asked her if she'd like to go to a movie. I couldn't look at the movie. I had to keep looking at her. I was nuts about her. I asked her to marry me.
On your first date?
Yeah. And she called Wisconsin. Said, I met a real great girl.
Bob drops his gaze.
It's simple.
He wears a sad expression. Old color footage shows Joyce in a wedding dress. She walks down the aisle with her father.
But that's where you came in.
Joyce meets Bob at the altar.
Your loving arms have saved me from.
In black and white wedding photos, Bob and Joyce smile.
And then a very similar thing happened with a lovely lady who is now Elizabeth Sherman.
I came back from a trip, and who was there? The girl that I wanted to look up in the first place that I had met a few weeks earlier.
He asked me if I would like to hear a record he had just gotten, and I said, oh, sure, what did you buy? And he said, well, I didn't exactly buy it. And I said, what did you do, steal it? Because he had told me he was in the insurance business. And I was losing interest quickly because I thought he was too excited to see me and he lies.
Elizabeth taught me how to laugh at things, changed my whole perception of life.
Footage shows Dick and Elizabeth's wedding. They kiss outside a church. The footage freezes on Dick and Elizabeth hugging.
I think I'm instrumental in being Cupid on those two things, for just having a nice place for people to meet.
I got one room in a building in Hollywood, and I let everybody know that I was publishing.
What was the name of your publishing company?
Music World Corporation.
Bob had a determination to publish songs on his own.
I wrote with different partners. One of them was Bob Roberts.
They were having a bit of success together, and I was doing my own thing, writing on my own.
I didn't want to write with him. We're going our own directions.
He did say, come up. If you have a good song you think you have, nobody else wants it, bring it over here. Maybe I can do something with it. One day I was driving down Santa Monica Boulevard, and there was a sign, and it said, The Tall Girls Shop. Tall. Ooh, that's a good word, tall.
Bob Roberts and I had a start of a song called Chalk on the Sidewalk, Writing on the Wall. And Dick came in and he joined us.
A note on an album reads, To Mom and Dad with all our love, Bob and Dick, 220-59. Tall Paul, Annette Funicello.
Walt Disney Company. They were looking for a song for Annette Funicello, who was a big star of the Mouseketeers. We always called her our lucky star because she started it.
It became a smash.
A chart shows the song at number 7.
Bob Roberts was not too happy about the fact that the kid brother was coming into the thing. And we wrote a lot of songs, the three of us.
At one point, there was a big fight. Roberts said, I think I should add more bass. Dick said, no.
All of a sudden, he lost his cool. He threw a pair of scissors at me across this sound booth. Whap, like that. I pulled out of the way, thank God. Bob got up, grabbed him, and shoved him out of the door.
And I said, I never want to see that guy again. And from then on, Dick and I wrote together.
Many records flash by. Words appear. You're 16, Johnny Burnett. Glimpses show Bob and Dick with their families.
You're beautiful and you're mine.
Dad and Dick were occasionally landing songs and getting some airplay, but their families were growing and it was tough to make ends meet.
Old footage shows Bob and Dick's children. Annette smiles on various album covers.
We started writing more songs for Annette. She recorded about 15 of them.
Take three, Baker, all that, Pineapple Princess.
And you guys knew how nervous I was. And you were so supportive. And
well, you see, the trick was, you know what Tootie said to me? He said, anytime she looks like she's a little worried about the song, you go and sing it for her. She knows she can sing it better than you.
Pineapple Princess.
Bob had gotten a phone call from the musical director of the Disney Record Company. He said, the studio wants to put Annette into a film and they need a song for her. Would you guys like to take a shot at writing it? I said, you're kidding, really? He said, yes, but they need it right away.
So he drove to the studio and there was a big fence. There was a guard there.
We thought we'd have to pay to park because we had about 35 cents between us.
So we parked outside the studio and we walked in. Jimmy Johnson, the head of the music company at Disney, said, Walt wants to hear it. Walt Disney.
So Bob and I, terrified, walked into Walt Disney's office.
And he started talking about a picture with two girls that were sisters. They were twins, but they had never met. They meet in summer camp. We let him go for a while. We said, but Mr. Disney, where...
We didn't let him go. This was Walt Disney talking to us. You don't interrupt... a man like that, but at a certain point, Bob got the courage to say, Mr. Disney, we came here to play you a song for the Horse Masters. And we played the first song we ever wrote for a Disney production, and that was a song called Strummin' Song.
So ho hum, let's sing a strummin' song.
Ho hum, let's sing a strummin' song.
Ho hum, one that we can hum along.
Ho hum, one that we can hum along.
He listened to the song, and he said, yeah, that'll work. And we got kind of confused. What do you mean it'll work? It's a good song. We didn't realize that when he said it'll work, he meant it'll work.
Walt, of course, was never quite satisfied with anything, but he would drag you into doing something even better than you thought you could.
He said, listen, I wasted a lot of time on this other thing, so why don't you get him a script and maybe we can come up with a song for this picture.
Dick plays piano.
Let's get together, yeah, yeah, yeah. Why don't you and I combine? Let's get together, what do you say? We could have a swinging time.
And though we haven't got a lot, we could be sharing all we've got together.
Bob and Dick were just always warm and sweet and loving, and I can remember them now sitting there playing and laughing. And
and it could be great to say, hey, alligator.
You know, I felt that I knew them of old.
Let's get together. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Someone flips through a book.
One propitious day, Walt took this little red book off his shelf and he handed it to us.
The book was called Mary Poppins. He said, you know what a nanny is? We said, yeah, goat. He said, no, it's a British nursemaid. Said, oh, okay.
This time he just said, tell me what you think. We knew he was interested in us as writers, as thinkers.
We found six chapters in her books that we could put together and make a story.
We had just written about 16 bars of various songs. 2 weeks later, we brazenly asked, could we have a half an hour of Walt's very, very valuable time. And we stayed there for about 2.5 hours. And he was as enthusiastic as we were with what we were doing.
We circled the 6 chapters. He smiled. He turned around, got his copy, opened it to the index. The same 6 chapters were unblind. It was a miracle.
He said, play me that Bird Lady song again.
Their young ones are hungry, their nests are so bare. All it takes is tuppence from you.
He looked at us and he said, that's what it's all about, isn't it?
He said, you guys like to write, don't you? I said, yes, sir. I would like to come here.
Bob wears an emotional expression.
Right for me.
We said, we'd love to go for the studio. And
Dick's eyes well up.
That was the day. That was the day.
He averts his gaze. A black and white photo shows the Sherman Brothers with Walt Disney. A.J. Carruthers, Disney staff screenwriter.
I think probably I'm the only person who is really close to both of them, has ever been really close to both of them, either professionally or personally, and was close to both their wives.
A.J. Carruthers, one of Walt's favorite writers, became one of ours. We were very close.
Bob loved A.J. too, and his wife Carol, and we just kind of got along. Everybody was kind of fond of each other then.
Working with them in the 60s, we were happily ensconced at Disney. We were all three very happy there.
Walt Disney gave them a home. That was very unusual for songwriters.
They were the only songwriters that Walt ever had under contract.
The Sherman Brothers are not only very talented, but very cooperative. They go for the team play, you know. That's the way we work here. It's a team.
They never knew what the next assignment was going to be, but there would be one just around the corner.
Tinkerbell waves her wand. Countless movie titles float by.
Walt Disney presents
The Wonderful World of Color.
Tinkerbell waves her wand.
When we started getting paid by the Disney company, it was marvelous.
It was the second week that we were coming out of the studio. We had gotten our first $500 check each. They're paying us money to write songs. Couldn't believe it.
It was exciting. That's more money than we ever had.
Bob's car was in front of mine, and he held up 5 like that. And I held up 5, and I waved back at him like that.
And that was our hand signal. As the weeks went on, it was $600. And we were just reveling in our relationships with the studio and with Walt.
Walt always knew that music was about story. Walt was all about story. He was a great storyteller. And both Bob and Dick were great storytellers, too.
The Sherman Brothers, for more or less the first time, brought a musical theater sensibility to screen projects. That was, I think, very influential.
We have a very definite philosophy. We don't start anything without an idea.
The idea came first, then the music and the lyrics followed.
And we both throw lines to each other back and forth, and we sort of Shermanize, we like to call it.
So many people pigeonholed their songs as children's songs.
I didn't write kiddie songs, I wrote songs for kiddies.
These are lyrics which have words in them that are not in common currency, or they're words that stretch the imagination.
Fortuosity, that's me own word.
Higgitus, 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 oh, fresh and gentlemanly.
A heffalumperwoozle is very confusable.
Substitutionary locomotion, come to me.
I'll have fun with you, you'll have fun with me. It's fundamental friend dependability.
We didn't want to write down the kids. I wanted them to learn new words, precocious and supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
We all had offices in the animation building, and I heard know, these songs, of course, over and over and over again because I was in the same corridor.
The biggest word you ever heard, this is how it goes. I blew it right there. I blew those words, the notes.
And Dick tends to not be very soft-pedaled when he's playing his, singing his songs.
Once in a while, Bob and I would, like, be screaming some lyric or something, and then a little Russell would come under the door.
A wonderful cartoonist named Roy Williams. I used to hear whatever went on in our office, write what he heard.
If you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
A better?
Cartoons in a sketchy style depict the brothers creating their music.
Oh. That was the best one.
My brother Dick was spontaneous. I always was slow and plodding. He was in there. And it was exciting. It's great to work with a guy who's a spark plug.
When we come up with a good song idea, there were no two happier guys in the world. We just jumped for joy. It was just fantastic, and we knew it. We both look at each other, yeah, we did it, yeah.
They had the reputation, which was largely true, I think, that they could write a song over lunch hour and bring the next song back to you.
When something is so ingrained in the culture, people don't even have a connection with the fact that two guys sat in a room and had to actually work and create that.
I was in their office, and Richard, Dick, would sit just playing the melody really loud and just shouting out lyrics, anything that came into his head.
Put it in the album, the family album. Put it in the album, the family album.
Robert was sitting at his big desk, listening. And every couple of minutes, as Dick just went on just shouting things, Robert would raise his hand like this. Dick would stop mid-chord, and Robert would say one thought.
Our friends will love it. Your friends will love it.
Well, okay, what can you rhyme with love it, love it?
Put the date above it.
And Dick would go, oh, my God. And boom, go right in and sing the perfect line.
All your friends will love it. Your family album with the dates above it. The family album.
Dick was always very easy to goof around with. We always thought of him as Mr. Sunshine. Bob was much more retiring, and I didn't entirely know whether that was because he was shy or whether there was a sort of dark aspect to him that countered Dick's sunshine.
Clearly, one might say, oh, gee, Bob's moody. I think that is so skimming the surface of one of the most complex people I've ever met.
Bob is a little more feed the birds, I think, and Dick is a little more supercalifragilistic.
The closest analogy that I've ever been able to come up with is John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And if you think of Paul McCartney, bubbly, effusive, very much like Dick, you think of John Lennon, a little more sardonic, a little darker, like Bob. They would keep the songs from being too sugary and giving it just that little bit of adult twist to it.
Up where the smoke is all billowed and curled, between pavement and stars is the chimney sweep world.
What the Sherman Brothers did with Walt Disney, they made these perfect moments where dialogue, visuals, animation, whatever, cannot communicate an emotion as good as that Sherman Brothers song.
On the rooftops of London,
the sun sets.
Cool. What a sight.
As a filmmaker now, I don't forget those moments.
A man has dreams of walking with giants, to carve his niche in the edifice of time.
Walt kept putting off Mary Poppins. Finally, I learned that he didn't have the rights.
We had poured ourselves for 2.5 years into this project, dreaming of it and thinking about it.
There was a woman who wrote the basic stories called Mrs. Travers, Pamela Travers.
The photo shows P.L. Travers, author Mary Poppins.
I didn't know until later, but I heard it that she had to agree to sell him this stuff, but he put on with Bob and Dick and with Don DeGrady and Bill Walsh. this enormous show for her.
These are two giant boats, titanic vessels, heading on a collision course. And somewhere in between is a little raft on which are sitting Bob and Dick Sherman.
When the day is gray...
No, 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 come on. No, 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 no. No, no, don't make it like that.
She was a very feisty, ramrod straight old lady.
She didn't really hit it off with children, oddly enough, for somebody who was so famous in the world of children's literature.
She was a witch.
Book freaked me out as a kid. She breaks her fingers off, and it's gingerbread, and she's kind of unpleasant.
I beg of you not to do that. You're going to spoil the whole thing.
She didn't like any of the ideas we had from her book. None of them.
She didn't appreciate the genius of what they had come up with.
Walt said, listen, I have a lot of work to do, and he just got up and left the room.
I'd give anything to be there with you, but this seems to be one of those times I'm tied down here at the studio night and day.
Now, look, I do not think this is right.
You had to say the right thing and try to press the right buttons with her.
Well, if your stars want to make this a great picture, you want to do justice in some way to the magic of this wonderful pile of books here, we love Mary Poppins. We really do.
Thank you.
She grudgingly finally came through. They made the movie that they saw fit to make.
In the movie, Mary Poppins floats down from the sky with her umbrella. The wind carries the prim woman to a doorstep as the children watch. Julie Andrews gives an interview.
It's her. It's the person.
I was very daunted by the thought of doing my first movie ever. Those songs were so compelling, and that's what made me feel, yeah, I think if I was given half a chance, I would be able to cut it.
Bob and Dick Sherman, they play the songs for me. I've never been so impressed or enthralled in my life. And I said, oh, God, I've got to be part of this.
But through the eyes of love, you can start.
One of the songs that Dick and Bob really loved when they originally played us the score was, I think, called The Eyes of Love. And given how incredibly positive Julie responded to the score, they were really kind of startled when she said, you know, I'm not sure about The Eyes of Love.
She thought it was too direct. It was not oblique enough for Mary Poppins' character.
This was one of the most important numbers to us, and we were kind of heartbroken about it. When Walt said, try to write something that would be more in keeping with the way Mary Poppins would feel.
This one day I came home from school, and all the shades were closed in this room he was sitting in. He was sitting in a chair. I didn't even see him right away. It was so dark in the house. He asked me, how was your day? And I said, I had the Salk vaccine at school. And he said, well, you let somebody give you a shot, and did it hurt? And I said, no, they took out this plastic spoon and put a sugar cube on and put the medicine in it, and you just ate it. And I saw my dad go like this.
Jeff nods.
And with that, I said, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. And I couldn't wait to tell Dick the next morning. I said, spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. He said, what? He said, you're nuts.
For a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. The medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.
Both of the boys, Bob and Dick, were there all the time because they were so involved in it and so in love with it.
Richard and Bob were right down at eye level with me, and we were all in this team together.
Never be cross or cruel, never give us castor oil or gruel.
Richard's always reminded me of the little errant penguin runs onto the screen, madly in love with Mary and bumping into everything. That's Richard Sherman.
In the movie, an animated penguin kisses Mary Poppins' cheek. She smiles. Karen Dotrice, Jane Banks.
Robert Sherman, devastatingly handsome, very sartorial, trying to describe to we kids what the scene was about.
I was at a party the other night, and a 22-month-old girl, I mean that tall, walked up. She said, hi, Bert. And I said, hi, what's your name? She said, Mary Poppins. She stepped on my lap, and we sang the entire song of It's a Jolly Holiday with Mary.
Mary makes your odds so light.
You haven't changed a bit, have you?
When the die is gray and ordinary, Mary makes the sun shine bright.
Oh, honestly.
That's the third, maybe the fourth generation of children that are charmed by that movie. It's a great tribute to the Sherman Brothers.
We kind of stepped into the big time in a real serious way with Mary Poppins.
Hollywood goes to a world premiere.
It was a real live-action movie. My goodness, look at Disney doing this sort of thing.
Here in the forecourt of the renowned Grauman's Chinese Theater, all of Hollywood awaits the world premiere of Walt Disney's Mary Poppins. It appears that Walt Disney is arriving.
Walt steps out of a limousine.
Walt's last premiere was in 1937 for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Bob and Dick and wives were in a limo together on the creeping up to the front of the Chinese theater with the window down. Some little girl poked her head in the window and looked at them looking for celebrities and said, they're not anybody. And Joyce Sherman goes, we are too, somebody. I always loved that story, you know. And of course, by the time the evening was over, they were somebody.
Well, they have the parking lot tented with parties, and we're coming out of the theater, and Mrs. Travers is coming out with Walt.
She didn't look too happy. She really was not too pleased.
She said, well, I guess we'll have to roll our sleeves up and get it straight.
And he looked at her and said, Pamela, the ship has sailed.
Riding on a boat, Walt Disney tips his cap. Marty Schuyler gives an interview.
The period, 1963 to 69, basically, Walt brought songs and music into the parks for the first time. The first one was Tiki Room, which Bob and Dick wrote.
The Sherman Brothers' music within the amusement park rides, it takes you to those places. You forget about the long line you just stood in. You are taken away.
Welcome to our tropical hideaway, you lucky people, you. If we weren't in the show starting right away, we'd be the audience.
We were given the assignment to do a song for the UNICEF Pavilion at the World's Fair, which was called UNICEF Salutes the Children of the World.
The first time I met Dick and Bob, we had set up a test of how we were going to do the music from different countries, and it was a mess.
It sounded like a million kids. All singing different things. It was a cacophony. Walt says, can you write one song that'll cover everything? We said, well, we'll try.
It's a world of laughter, a world of tears. It's a world of hope.
People think it's a little novelty. It's a prayer for peace. We have to learn to live together and respect each other, or we're going to blow each other up.
I get so moved in the boat going through that and seeing all the children. There is something that is just so wonderfully moving, and the song always gets to me.
It's like this life-changing experience as a child when you go on it, because it's sort of kind of scary, but not.
You do spend about 5 minutes in there with that thing just cycling around endlessly in your ear.
Once it's in your head, it's just there forever, in a good way.
It's a lovely song. The first 4,000 or 5,000 times you hear it. And then it just like drills into your brain.
You wake up in the middle of the night and it's still going.
It's a small world after all.
No! No! Anything but that. I have this image of both your fathers sitting there like, ah!
It's probably the most important thing that's in any of the parks. Wouldn't it be wonderful if people acted like the words of that song.
In 1964, we all flew together on Walt's private plane to the World's Fair, where they were introducing It's a Small World. And when the ride was about a third of the way through, the tape broke. And the four of us stood up and sang It's a Small World for the rest of the ride, which was really fun. We had a good time together.
It's a small world.
Jerry Lewis said that when he and Dean Martin started out as a team, that Lou Costello gave them advice that he had gotten from Stan Laurel, and that was never let your wives socialize with each other. Where you get four people involved in it, then personalities take over, and it doesn't work.
The wives were very different one from the other, as were their husbands. So I think had they not been brothers, they are two couples that never would have had a relationship because I don't think they had enough in common.
Dick has never changed from the day they were above that cleaning shop.
very careful about where his money is spent. He probably has a big coffee can in his backyard full of gold.
Dad is probably the most generous human being on the planet. I liked Lori Partridge. I wanted a keyboard, so he got me this entire huge, like, church organ. And I think I played it 8 times on total.
Bob would be more the businessman, and I'd be more the other guy. I would do things for nothing, just for the fun of it.
Dick thought that Bob was, you know, extravagant and threw money around, and Bob thought that Dick was, closed-fisted and uptight, and so their lifestyles were different, and so they didn't enjoy being together.
So there's a great big beautiful tomorrow shining at the end of every day. There's a great big beautiful tomorrow, just a dream away.
Well, it sounds pretty good. In fact, that's just the right spirit. Our songwriters, Dick and Bob Sherman of the Walt Disney Studio.
Bob and Dick wrote that as a tribute to Walt, about Walt's optimism.
Thanks, boys.
Thanks, Walt.
Say goodbye to the folks.
Bye-bye.
There's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow.
As I said, that's the spirit.
Walt was a marvelous, creative person with a lot of imagination, like our dad.
A man plays guitar. Lawrence Juber, lead guitarist, Wings. Footage shows the 37th Annual Academy Awards, April 5th, 1965.
We were amazed to be nominated because it was our very first time out with a major picture.
It was like we were walking on air.
Old footage shows Bob, Dick, and Julie Andrews at the venue. A crowd waves while photographers aim cameras. Young Debbie Reynolds crosses the stage to the podium.
What do you remember about the 1965 Oscars?
Well, I just remember that we were all gorgeous.
For best music score. Oh, God bless you. The winners are Richard M. Sherman and Robert B. Sherman for Mary Poppins.
Dick kisses his wife on the cheek and makes his way to the stage. Julie Andrews cheers from the audience. On stage, Bob uses a cane to walk. The brothers accept their statuettes from Debbie, then stand at the podium.
We're so touched. We want to thank the inspiring Mr. Walt Disney, Mr. Bill Walsh,
Mr. Don DeGrady,
and
Erwin Kostel, Bob Stevenson, our
Julie
wonderful
Andrews,
cast, Dick Van Dyke.
Dick Van Dyke.
There are so many people connected with Mary Poppins, I'm sure we left quite a lot of them out.
We'll stay up all night thinking of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Academy, very much.
We had both won 2 Academy Awards, so we took pictures with Julie. We posed with one of them behind our backs so that it wouldn't look like we were overpowering her.
The brothers shake hands.
Overnight, every doorman, every maitre d', every waiter knew our names.
2 old photos show Bob and Dick posing with their wives in awards.
The next day, we went to Walt's office to thank him.
So we marched in with our 4 Oscars, and we put them on his desk. And he's working away on a script, and he looks up and he says, "Well, boys,
congratulations. You had a home run.
But remember, you had the bases loaded.
Now just try to get on base."
A chart shows the Mary Poppins soundtrack at the top.
Mary Poppins was the breakout hit all songwriters dreamed to have. The question always is, what's next?
She loves a man.
Annette with the Beach Boys, 1965.
Nose like a Geiger. Oh, what a tiger is.
Bobby Darin.
That darn cat.
When we were given this book to begin with, we couldn't get with it at all.
Kitty stuff. We weren't very impressed.
I was their sort of resident Brit, and as a kid, a fanatical Pooh fan. I think they're exaggerating, but they used to say my enthusiasm for it had triggered a kind of creative release for them.
Oh, he said, Winnie the Pooh, he saved my life. I was a tubby little kid, but Winnie the Pooh was tubby, but he was wonderful.
When I up, down, touch the ground, it puts me in the mood. Up, down, touch the ground, in the mood for food.
Bob, I remember, looked at me and he said, deep in the 100-acre wood where Christopher Robin plays. I said, oh, my God, don't stop. Hey, stop. And I said, deep in the 100-acre wood where Christopher Robin plays,
you'll find the enchanted neighborhood of Christopher's childhood days. Winnie the Pooh, Winnie the Pooh, tubby little tubby all stuffed with fluff. He's Winnie the Pooh, Winnie the Pooh, willy-nilly silly old bear.
Just before I came to Disney, the AIDS crisis hit in New York. And unbeknownst to me, Howard was ill. In fact, most of the people I was working with were sick and dying. All we could watch were these Disney animated features. And I would just escape into them with my daughter on my lap. I remember that the balm for my heart was actually Winnie the Pooh. I'd be sitting going, Winnie the Pooh, Winnie the Pooh.
Walt, he would talk to them about a song that he thought might be good for an upcoming project. And Dick would go run to the piano and start playing something and say, how about this?
Bob, he was always very thorough. He called me Fast and Wrong Dick. That was his nickname for me. And sometimes I was wrong, I will admit. Sometimes I was right.
Bob really got annoyed with the I can have it for you in 10 minutes thing at times when he just lost it.
How'd you work with Uncle Dick?
Like brothers.
What would you do if you didn't like his ideas?
I'd tell him so.
What would you say?
It stinks. He'd say the same to me.
My father, Mike Connor, was the Sherman's manager for 30 years. He was also sort of their agent and lawyer, and given the relationship, he was also the referee and the mediator.
And we argue quite a bit.
I'm going to disagree with you on film.
They could argue about almost anything.
It's akin to poetry.
But it has to be sung, so it really, truly isn't poetry in itself.
And almost at the drop of a hat.
But it telescopes in the space of time.
Okay. And you just sort of completely threw me, because I didn't know if you were disagreeing with me.
Because his question
we shouldn't, this shouldn't be on the film.
A lot of my choice of lyricists is based actually on who I want to be in the room with. If I had to collaborate with one of my siblings, it's sort of unthinkable.
And smile.
The public perception of their happy partnership and jovial sibling relationship was not true. The crucible of creativity for these guys is conflict.
Photos show the brothers as young men sitting together. Now older, they work at a piano.
If you study, you won't muddy. If you study, you won't muddy.
I'm the proudest daughter. It gives me the biggest thrill to see my father make the world so happy. But if my father loses his temper, the roof might come off. He can be quite explosive and loud. That's just an artist being an artist.
I got angry about something. And I remember once I pushed the piano away and it came, because I said, oh, damn it. And the piano went clunk on the floor. That's it. I didn't kill anybody, you know. But these are things, you know, we're brothers. We just, listen, we're human beings, and break a piano or break a typewriter. You know, now you have computers. You can't hurt a guy too much with a computer.
How did you deal with my dad's temper?
I dodged it as much as I could. I didn't really acknowledge it.
Often he would come home from work frustrated and angry with something Dick had done or said that day, and he'd want to leave the team. And my mother would instantly pull out this typewriting table, put it in the middle of the room and say, go ahead, write your novel. He'd write a poem or a short story and those frustrations would subside. Privately, Mom did more to keep the Sherman brothers together than anyone ever knew.
As time went on and their relationship became more and more strained, it was more difficult, of course, to work together.
Concept art shows ancient ruins in a jungle. Mowgli and Bagheera the panther stand near elephant statues.
Walt was not happy with the first version of Jungle Book the way it was going, and he decided to scrap practically everything except one wonderful song by Terry Gilkison called The Bare Necessities, which everybody knows and loves.
Walt called us in. I'd like you to Disneyfy it. Have fun with the apes. So we wrote, I Want to Be Like You.
Now I'm the king of the swingers, oh, the jungle VIP. I've reached the top and had to stop, and that's what's bothering me.
We figured that Louis Prima would be the ideal character. And so we went to Las Vegas, played the song for Louis and the boys. They loved it.
The animated characters mimic a live band.
He had Louis' band filmed so the animators could pick up their movements. It was ridiculous, but it was funny.
We could have Elton John come in here right now, I promise you, because he's done it for me, and sing the entire song score to Jungle Book. These songs are known by everybody.
Trust in me, just in me. Shut your eyes and trust in me.
Old footage shows Bob strolling on a sidewalk.
Sometimes he would actually not come in. And I thought, well, he's just not feeling well or something. And I don't know, it started happening like that.
Bob came to my office and told me that he was leaving, that he wouldn't be around for a while. He was worn out with everything. And he was very depressed, profoundly depressed. He didn't know where he was gonna go, but he was gonna be gone.
Bob said, you got to do this for me. I can't do this. I have to have some clothes. I got to get out of here. And then you're going to have to help me. You're the only one who can do it for me. And I was reluctant. I didn't want to do it, but I did because he's my brother.
Tensions had been mounting between Dick's family and ours. For my mom, Dick showing up at our house to get Dad's clothes was the last straw.
A lot of misunderstandings took place because I was trying to be kind to my brother and help him. Jeff, as a little boy, used to sit on my lap, and I'd loved him. He was a beautiful little boy, and we just had a simpatico. It was fantastic. And I didn't see him after that.
A couple of days later, Dad was back, and no one ever talked about it.
Bang, we just went. We'd see each other at events, and we'd always keep a nice front in front of everybody. Nobody ever suspected that Bob and I didn't see each other socially. This is painful stuff. I don't know. I that's enough. I don't want to talk about that.
Do you have a favorite Sherman Brothers song?
Yeah.
Which one?
Called On the Front Porch. A beautiful little old-fashioned song.
A clip plays.
Three creaky wooden chairs.
Those squeaky rocking chairs.
Glimpses show the brothers' families.
A well-worn welcome mat, the lattice vines, the happy times. All I wanna do when the day is through is linger here on the front porch with you. Oh, how I love to linger here like this, hold your hand and steal a kiss or two.
On the front porch with you.
Dick attends a premiere for The Happiest Millionaire.
In the 60s was a time when the movie musical was starting to fade out a bit in Hollywood. I always thought of the Sherman Brothers as these really great heroes as long as there were musicals there. But they were the kind of the flag bearers alone.
The Happiest Millionaire was my first film. It was an amazing, amazing entrance into movies with the Sherman Brothers. The song is a scene in and of itself.
Then I'll know that
I'll know that I
reached into the
sky.
I reached into the sky and touched a star.
And the Shermans had that ability to write singable songs that had this simplicity that let the performer shine.
Walt poses with the stars of The Happiest Millionaire.
What did Walt say to you when you walked out of The Happiest Millionaire screening?
Keep up the good work, boys.
And it was kind of strange because he never said something like that. And then he walked down the hall again. That's the last time I ever saw him.
He had cancer. He was saying goodbye.
A newspaper shows an obituary for Walt Disney.
Walt dying happened pretty suddenly to most people.
I loved him very much.
Privately, with Dick and Bob, he didn't mind showing that he was emotional. And that was rare. We didn't see it.
This was Walt Disney's office. And often on Fridays, he'd ask us to come down and talk with him.
Then he'd say, he looked to me as I play it. And I pretty much knew what he wanted. He wanted to hear his favorite song. After he was gone, I'd still come down on a Friday afternoon and play it for him.
Feed the birds, tuppence a bag. Tuppence, tuppence, tuppence a bag.
In old footage, Walt feeds little birds. Leslie Ann Warren and Roy E. Disney give interviews.
There was that feeling that the daddy genius was gone.
And a lot of people wondering what we're going to do now without daddy there. You know, Walt was, I call him uncle, but he was daddy to an awful lot of people.
Markedly, from the time Walt died, the phone stopped ringing.
Nothing came to us. We had no good assignments.
There was some hostility towards the Shermans from other folks at the studio. Some thought that they were, you know, Walt's special boys.
It was like we weren't needed anymore. We felt like unnecessary cogs in the wheel.
Which was kind of about the time I decided it wasn't a lot of fun working there anymore, and I left.
The phone rang one day, and I thought it was going to be an assignment. It wasn't that at all. It was somebody saying, have you turned in your time cards for this week? And that was kind of strange, because that was something that never was done in Walt's time.
After a while, we just decided we wouldn't want to stay there anymore, and we left.
Barbara Broccoli.
My father had been producing the James Bond films. He really wanted to make a film for us, for us kids.
Opening titles for Chitty Chitty Bang Bang list the Sherman Brothers.
He used to say it was the happiest experience he ever had on a film, because he had a wonderful working relationship with the Shermans.
It's ironic that so many times people say that it's another one of Disney's great pictures, and it wasn't. It's actually Cubby Broccoli.
Oh, there was a principle. I remember we'd write a song, we played for him. He loved it.
We lived in London, and up on the sort of kids' area, there was a piano. And I remember the two of them playing songs for my father on that piano. They were like uncles, you know, they were really a major part of our growing up.
Dick Van Dyke somersaults.
Someone to care for, to be there for, I have you too. That song is my favorite from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. That and Hushabye Mountain.
A gentle breeze from Hushabye Mountain softly blows o'er Lullaby Bay.
When we were doing the show of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, you know, I would look around the audience and I would see grown men crying.
So close your eyes on
David Gilmour, Pink Floyd, lead guitarist, vocals.
They wrote something that is in a category by itself and will never be repeated by anyone unless they do it.
Sail far away from lullaby.
Good night.
I want every house in the square to be searched from top to bottom.
Come on, Captain.
When you look at the story of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, it's a very, very dark story, and a lot of it has the overtones of the Second World War and particularly the Nazis and having, you know, the extermination of children.
There are children here somewhere. I can smell them.
How do you think my dad's war experiences affected him?
Well, it did. It has cast a shadow over his life. I think that anyone that you hear of or speak to who had visited any of the camps, so they can never forget it.
I was the first American into the Dachau prison camp. My squad and I walked in, and we saw the four faded prisoners and had terrible experiences looking at corpses and ovens, and it was enough nightmares for the rest of my life.
What did you do when you came home from the war?
I relaxed, had a nervous breakdown.
A photo shows Bob in uniform.
In 1943, I was 17. I didn't know a thing about anything. But I learned.
In the present, he gazes outside.
He never talked too much about it. He didn't talk about it. I don't think he wanted to.
Bob paints.
I've been painting many years, even before I was a songwriter. I love painting. I had to get rid of the thoughts of Dachau and the thoughts of explosions and pain in the hospitals.
We glimpse paintings.
Beautiful things helped clean my soul of the horror. The horror lasted a long time.
Angela Lansbury.
At that time, I didn't realize, and I don't think any of us did, what his personal experience had been in World War II.
Sound the advance!
A title card reads, In Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Just in time for the kickoff.
For Bob to have seen that and then have to reconstruct this ridiculous kind of little tableau of these phony German soldiers landing on the coast of Britain must have seemed like a play acting of the lowest order for him.
Which beds get to sleep on velvet mats? Naturellement, the aristocrats.
In the early 70s, Bob and I came back to Disney to complete work on two films, The Aristocats and Bedknobs and Broomsticks. But without Walt there, it just wasn't the same.
You must face the age of not believing, doubting everything you ever knew, until at last you start believing there's something wonderful in you.
Dad was our great catalyst. He kept us together. And he said on many occasions, as a team, you're going to make it. As a team, you'll be strong. If you start dividing it up and saying, I did this, you did that, I did this, you aren't going to have a team very long. So just get used to it.
Oh, we've got lots in common. Where it really counts, where it really counts, we've got a large amount.
I travel all over America, and I go to England, Australia. And what am I asked to autograph most of all is the album of Charlotte's Web.
Demo session with Joseph Barbera.
Great, right on the nose.
So Charlotte's Web was your favorite score?
Yeah, my dad liked that too. Great little pure songs.
How very special are we, for just a moment to be part of life's eternal rhyme.
It meant a lot to me also because I loved my parents And obviously they must have loved theirs a great deal.
Mother Earth and Father Time.
Mom and Dad both lived to see us win the Academy Awards. They both lived through a lot of our later successes. Up until the early 70s, they both were gone by then.
Mother Earth and Father Time.
After a funeral, the family receives fellow mourners at a home. Not this one. There were two. They didn't attend each other's receptions, and everybody else had to attend one or the other.
Ever since I was a little girl, I was told, well, if we meet at family events, you can wave hello and be polite, and that's best.
The first time that I met Richard Sherman and his wife Elizabeth was at an event, and they all went to another side of the theater, and I thought, this is kind of odd.
Another person's weird is our normal, so that's just the way it was growing up.
Dad got to the point of exhaustion with the sibling rivalry on a number of occasions, but he always found a way to get back up the next day and have a plan to bring his boys back together again.
He just knew that I'm soft-hearted. I was barely getting started. Now I'm taking all of my fun.
Don't you tell ya? No, I'm giving all my fun.
Okay.
I actually can remember going up to the Sherman Brothers' office where they were writing phrases and trying to link into script scenes.
John Williams, musical director, Tom Sawyer. John and the brothers work at a piano.
One of the beacons of American 19th century literature translated by the Shermans into something wonderfully viable musically.
Everything in their career has pushed them into being two halves of a whole. They are, by fate and fame, shackled together. How can that not have, at some point or other, have caused as many problems for them as individuals as it has caused joy and delight to all of us who've heard their music?
Glimpses show the brothers' works through the 70s, 80s, and early 90s.
River's gonna flow to the sea, and the
an old photo shows Bob and Dick with Johnny Whitaker from Tom Sawyer. Now older, Johnny sings.
Only once in his life is he free.
Bob was not as enthusiastic anymore. He would say, well, this is not exactly doing Slipper and the Rose, is it? It's not really doing Charlotte's Web, is it? Or maybe it was me. I guess maybe I grated on him or something. Bob would retreat to his own thoughts, and he would love to paint. He'd sit at home and paint and do all kinds of things like that and take trips up the coast. He would do all kinds of stuff that I just didn't. Why aren't you writing? I mean, this is the fun of life, is to write new songs.
It wasn't necessary. We didn't just write songs to write songs. If there was a requirement for a picture, we'd do it. That's all.
He became more Bob Sherman, and I became, stayed being Dick Sherman.
Howard and I are, but we're in this conference room, and we're presenting The Little Mermaid. And at a certain point, we're told by one of the people at Disney, you know, next door over there, the Sherman Brothers are over there. Really? He said, yeah. Yeah, we got to listen to them, but, you know, the implication being, you're our guys, you're the hip new guys, you're coming in and you're going to be, you know, we're going to be in business together. It was a surprising moment. I mean, on the one hand, I felt this pride that we were now entering this tradition. On the other hand, you feel the, sort of the fleeting nature of our importance in Hollywood or in show business.
I knew they wrote Small World. And I'm making a comedy that deals with this kind of fantasy land.
Balloons rise over an amusement park.
I said, write a real song that you would write for a theme park called Wonderworld. You know, you're talking to Bob and Dick. They're both here. but you're talking to them as individuals, not as a team. I asked Bob and Dick if they would be in the movie. I was surprised how thrilled they were. Bob was in a bar with Arthur Hiller and Ray Harryhausen, you know, and he was good.
In the movie.
Did you hear? Somebody shot Dave Thornton.
Somebody shot Uncle Dave.
Is there a TV here?
Dick's cameo was just in the parade. It was just a moment they trimmed.
Dick wears a band uniform.
He blew the whistle to lead the parade. I saw Bob. I said, hey, did you like yourself in the movie? And he said, yeah. But with the glee with which he said, I enjoyed more that you cut Dick out.
Old footage shows Lindsay and Mike Connor.
Dad died January 7th of 1993.
He used to be the one that filled in where Walt wasn't there and where Dad wasn't there. It would be Mike. And then Mike passed away. And so there was nobody putting us together anymore.
Bob is a romantic, and Dick is a sentimentalist. And a lot of people think that's the same thing, but it's not. F. Scott Fitzgerald had a wonderful definition. He said, a sentimental person thinks things will last, and a romantic hopes against hope they will not.
And then one day, Bob just said, I don't think we need the office anymore. We weren't getting these big assignments. And so I said, well, okay, we will then. I thought it was an end of an era. Yes.
Portraits of the brothers hang side by side.
Ironically, we got busy after that.
Kenny Loggins.
When we sat down to write the Tigger song, Richard said, well, I was thinking of something like this. That's the Tigger. And I kind of went, well, you know, I don't see me singing that. You know, and he turns to me and goes, well, what did you have in mind?
Sunny days and starry nights and lazy afternoons. You're counting castles in the clouds and humming little tunes.
I saw things happening that were so fast between the two of them that I didn't pay much attention to it. I just accepted it as the shorthand of two people who've worked together all their lives. They had mentioned to me that they'd been away from the Disney camp for quite a while, but I didn't realize how emotional it would be for them to have another shot at writing for, you know, a Disney movie, and let alone a Winnie the Pooh movie. And how appropriate that it should be called Your Heart Will Lead You Home.
At a concert at the Hollywood Bowl, the Winnie the Pooh characters skip around the piano. A photo shows Bob and Dick with Frank Wells, Disney president. Another shows them holding Mouse Car Awards beside Mickey Mouse. At a ceremony, the brothers sign their names in wet cement. Elsewhere, they each receive an award. Kneeling over the wet cement, the brothers leave handprints as a crowd watches. Our view lowers to their names in the cement among other celebrities. Wendy Liebman, Bob Sherman's daughter-in-law.
Joyce Sherman was this stunning woman with an amazing sense of humor. And she threw the most beautiful party. She loved to celebrate. I think Joyce knew that she was not well, and she planned this huge trip to Hawaii for the Bob Shermans. And it was just beautiful.
She had liver cancer. She was in the hospital for quite a while, you know, and he never left.
Bob stood by her side in the hospital. He would not leave. He was devoted to her till the very end.
A sign reads, Sherman House, 808. Photos show the interior of the house and Joyce standing in the yard. Wearing a nice dress, she poses with Bob, who wears a tuxedo. Our view scans across an elegant living room. Old footage shows Joyce smiling. At Bob's interview.
Did you always think that at some point in your life you'd move to London? Or?
No. But it so happened at a point in my life when I became a widower, I decided to change my whole background.
Bob
found that everywhere he went was a reminder, and he couldn't bear it, so that he had to get to some place where there were no memories.
Dick and I were at Bob's house, and Bob said to me, "I'm moving to England." And Dick said, "What?"
I didn't know, but he had leased out his house and taken an apartment and lives in London now.
In London, a statue of a man stands in a courtyard. A sign outside a building reads, "Western Marble Arch Synagogue." Inside, two paintings of bearded old men hang beside each other.
I donated these two paintings of mine to the temple. My wife's name is up there. It's dedicated to her.
You know, he always loved London, and it was kind of fortuitous that the show went into rehearsal at a time when he wanted to make a change, needed to make a change in his life.
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang London stage premiere, 2002. Bob stands with Sam Goldwyn Jr. He poses with his daughter Lori and her kids, then with Jeff's wife and kids. Tracy Sherman, Bob's daughter.
Robert Broccoli putting on the play there really kind of saved its life, I think. I'm grateful for that.
Dick performs on stage.
It's a small world after all. Come on, everybody.
He sits with Greg's sons.
It's a small world after all.
I really enjoy my life. I spend my time doing all the things I love to do.
Recent photos show Bob with his family.
After all, it's a small.
I think he keeps regretting the fact that he didn't write that big novel.
This is my book. A lot of stories. People I've known, a lot of sad stuff, a lot of funny stuff.
And on my 50th birthday, Bob surprised me and gave me this, personally cut it out and fixed it up and put it into this frame with a little note. And the note is something I'll treasure forever. The sun reflects upon our smiles. Now we awaken and the mirror lies. Time and place is transient. Only love and memory abide, for within our hearts the major music hides. On this, the celebration of your birth, your worth to me is more than I can say. It is rooted in the sun's.
Dick fights back tears.
In the suns of yesterday.
He shows the frame. Sitting with Greg, Jeff gives an interview.
You ask them how long it takes to write a song. Their old saying is your entire life and the time it takes to jot it down. And when you get to know them and understand what they've been through and with each other, it's almost like a Greek tragedy in a way. You know, they were put together to do these things. And then that friction is what makes these beautiful things come to life.
Signs on Broadway advertise Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins was truly the culmination of everything they'd had in their careers. It was an incredibly perfect score. Here it was going to premiere on Broadway, and they were going to be together.
Jeff watches Bob put on an ascot.
Does it go under the collar or stay over it?
I have no idea. I don't either.
Dick fastens a tie.
These things are the thing that drive me crazy, doing the right tie. Oh, I'm nervous. I can't help it. It's just twitchy today.
His wife fixes the tie.
You got it there?
I hope so.
In Bob's room.
So, Dad, you ready for your big night?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Mary Poppins Broadway premiere, November 15th, 2006.
That's my place.
Dick and Elizabeth walk beneath the marquee. Bob takes pictures with Jeff and his kids.
Jeff and I had hoped in doing this movie, it would give our dads an opportunity to reconnect.
Dick stands with Greg. Photographers take pictures. Dick and Elizabeth stand behind Bob. Later, Dick approaches Bob and Jeff.
Hey, bro. How are you doing, kid?
They pose for pictures. The brothers smile. Helping his dad stand, Jeff smiles softly.
In life, not everything turns out like a Sherman Brothers musical.
People pass by the theater. Bob looks around.
But somewhere in their songs, they do meet.
Dick's smile fades. In the small room lined with photos, Dick plays the piano. In his apartment, Bob paints by the window.
I didn't want to wallow in the sadness of the world. I want to bring happiness to people.
Well, we've had a good career together.
A photo shows the brothers holding their Academy Awards beside Fred Astaire. Our view trails over the many snapshots.
We're different people. We have different interests.
Bob paints.
Bob goes his way, I go my way.
The brothers work in their separate rooms. Bob's painting depicts a wintry scene resembling the view out his window.
I just like him to say, hey, I'm glad I did what I did.
When I look back at what I've done, I don't have any regrets.
A recent photo shows Bob and Dick outside Disney Studios. It gives way to an old photo of the brothers in the same place. Snapshots show the brothers with their awards, reading in a studio, and smiling as children. Fade to black. Words appear. All songs in this film by Al Sherman and his boys. Since production ended, the Sherman Brothers' career has continued to flourish. The Mary Poppins stage musical has opened in 8 countries. The stage production of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, for which the Sherman Brothers composed 6 new songs in 2001, is currently touring the United States. Bob Sherman's autobiography, Moose, has found a publisher. Busker Alley, featuring the Sherman Brothers' score, is optioned for Broadway. Booked by A.J. Carruthers. Directed by Tony Walton. He changed his wand to a baton, and that's how it all began. When the rhythm founds and the harmony sounds and the melody rolls around, presto change-o, you're 10 feet off the ground. When the rhythm bounds and the harmony sounds and the melody rolls around, out of this world and upward bound, 10 feet off the ground. Ooh, yes. Clips play as the credits roll.
Well, in Berg, oh, what a flying fool was he.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Well, an hour ago I could have said it. Expialidocious.
Or docious aliexpialistic fragicalirupus, backwards. Are you impressed? I am.
And I said, Mary Poppins is a great movie and would make a great stage musical. And I was right.
You know, it's a small world. It was invented by the Red Chinese. It's a torture thing.
They brought so many people so much joy. And if angst produces it, maybe they should keep it up. Although I would like to see them hug and kiss each other just once.
A space shuttle floats over Earth.
Good morning, Pam, and thank you so much for that great wake-up music, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Thanks, Lori. That's one of my favorite Sherman Brothers songs. The shuttle may not have fine 4 fenders, but it's got 2 beautiful wings, and we're looking forward to a smooth touchdown later today.
Sweet.
like this. Dreadful. Some people laugh through their teeth, goodness sakes, hissing and fizzing like snakes. Not at all attractive to my way of thinking.
Some laugh too fast. Some only blast.
Ah!
Others, they twitter like birds.
You know, you're as bad as he is.
Then there's a kind what can't make up their mind. When things strike me as funny, I can't hide it inside and squeak, as the squeakers do. I got to let go with a ho. And we love to laugh loud and long and clear. We love to laugh so everybody can hear.
A photo shows Bob and Dick Sherman. National Medal of Arts, the White House, November 2008. A glowing pinpoint of light arcs over a castle with spires and flags. Walt Disney Pictures. Audio description by WGBH with funding by Disney. Voiced by Andrew Green.